Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Freddie Sayers and this is Unheard. Back in March, everyone's world suddenly changed.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
So on day one of lockdown, we launched Lockdown TV, a place where we could gather experts, scientists, writers, politicians, thinkers, to try to help us understand what was going on in this strange moment and what kind of world we were going to get at the end of it. And now, due to popular demand, here we are in podcast form. Welcome to Lockdown TV.
Today, we're going to be talking about someone called Ian Murray. What's happened to him in recent months is a really interesting case study and tells us a lot about some of the issues to do with free speech and the state of the media that we have been investigating here at Unheard. So I'm delighted that he's joining us now. So you've been a journalist and involved in the UK media for 40 years or more. And until very recently, you were executive director of the Society of Editors, which is a industry body that represents and campaigns on behalf of a free press. Is that a fair summary?
The society does not represent the individual organisations. What it represents is those basic facts. The theme behind, shall we say, of a free press, freedom of expression, and the public's right to know. So when the society speaks, it doesn't speak on behalf of say Rupert Murdoch or the BBC or the Telegraph. What it does is it speaks on those principles.
I'd like to go through in a little bit of detail what happened to you. So we had the Duchess of Sussex and the Duke of Sussex did their big interview with Oprah. We were then all talking about the accusations of racism within the royal family and within the media, the UK press that Meghan launched. And you were there in the media in the days afterwards, essentially defending the press as the representative from the Society of Editors from the charge of racism.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
So you didn't think, and you put out a statement to this effect, from the society, you didn't think that accusation that the British press was racist was a fair accusation.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I stand by that today. I think we expected that the Duke and Duchess would attack the British press, probably over privacy, because after all they've been going on about that for quite some time. But the statement that came out took me particularly by surprise to actually accuse sections of the British press of being bigoted, of being racist, and implying that that had played a part in some of the negativity of the coverage of the Duchess ever since she'd arrived in Britain. What I didn't say in a statement was that there are no examples to be found anywhere in any coverage in the British media that could be construed as being racist.
So your statement says that the UK media is not bigoted and will not be swayed from its vital role holding the rich and powerful to account following the attack on the press by the Duke and Duchess of Sussex.
It was a strong statement, but that was to counterbalance the fact of it. There is no proof, no evidence, or come up with proof and evidence that there is a general theme of racism, of bigotry in the British media or large sections of the British media, that they have got a racist agenda in that sense. That is simply untenable, I believe, and I stand by that statement today. And that's the statement that I put out as front man, spokesperson for the Society of Editors.
What happened then is quite interesting, and I'm afraid is becoming a bit of a pattern we have got to know in recent years, which is that there began to be a campaign against your statement, against what you had said. Haroon Siddiq, who is the Guardian's legal affairs correspondent, put together a letter which was signed by 255 journalists of colour, rejecting the assertion that the UK press is not racist. Someone called Charlene White, an ITV presenter of Afro-Caribbean descent, also objected to it and pulled out of hosting the Society of Editors Awards in protest at what you had said. We had the editor of the Yorkshire Post, who issued a statement withdrawing his team from the Society of Editor Awards. And we had the editor-in-chief of The Guardian distancing her paper from your statement. Editor of the I paper denounced it, and so on and so forth. So you had the slightly, you might say, unusual situation where the journalists you were trying to defend, or members of the press you were trying to defend from the charge of racism, turned on you because you said they weren't racist. Is that what happened?
If you look at the statements that came out from the number of these media organisations, they didn't go so far as to say, we agree with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex that the sections of the British media are racist. What they actually said was, we disagree with the statement put out by Mr Murray, because we believe that there are areas that can be looked at and that we should be considered, and more that can be done to be inclusive and those kind of things, which is fine, and I agree with, and I never said that wasn't the case. But if you disagree with a bold statement that the British media is not racist, is not bigoted, then you're obviously saying that it is. Let me just stress here, I don't believe that any of those editors or any of those people were targeting particularly the Society of Editors. They were not, I don't take it personally against me. What was coming to the fore was the growing war within the British media between the two sides, shall we say, of the debate of left and right, which we've seen writ large in the United States that was there. And this was an opportunity to back a claim, a quite nasty claim, against the right of the media, by the left of the media, shall we say.
So what you're saying is that those segments of the left-leaning media, what they really wanted was for the Daily Mail and the right-leaning tabloid press to be convicted, as it were, of the charge of racism, and they didn't like the idea that you were defending them.
So there were... I'm not going to say that I can put myself completely into the minds of those editorial teams on those papers and others that are there. But certainly they wanted to side with those statements from the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, and this was an opportunity to go for it. And I'd miscalculated that in the febrile atmosphere that exists today, that those old understandings of, well, okay, you have a right to a voice, and we're not going to completely trash you, were breaking down in that way. That their responses were quite measured. It was a growing campaign outside of that, and the piling in of the mob that seriously became the problem, and then got up ahead of steam, pressured against the society and against me. And I could see this coming quite quickly. Once I'd seen the reaction to the statement that I put out, I could see the end game, quite quickly. It was there because, after 40 years in the media, I'm there, and it must be utterly bewildering for anyone that's caught up in this that doesn't understand the media and thinks that if they can just simply say no, that's not what I said, no, that's not true, and here's the proof, and I can show you, and that they can silence the mob, and you can't.
So what happened next?
As I say, I quickly realised where the end game was coming from this. I could see that the role of the Society of Editors was going to be, at the very least, severely damaged. Its ability to actually represent the principles of a free press in this country were going to be very damaged, if not destroyed, by the fact that if it was going to lose the confidence and support of one side of the industry, and that something needed to be done quite quickly to actually stop that from happening. And the idea that this organisation, which I'd helped to found 22 years ago as one of the founding editors, I spent 10 years on the board, I was president for 1 year and had taken over, 4 years ago as executive director, that this was now going to be severely damaged, no. And the very, very thin silver lining in the way that the attacks were coming was they were getting very personal about me. When the mob turns, they need a target. And, you know, it's vicious. The phone calls, the hate, the threats of violence and worse, actually reaching to me, into my home, to my family, with phone calls and all kinds of things. And I calculated that if I was going to save the Society of Editors, I needed to walk away. I needed to walk away, and I hoped would take the heat with me. And I calculated that correctly, I believe.
So were you pushed or did you jump?
Oh, no, don't go wrong. I was not pushed. I came to the conclusion quite rapidly that there was only one course of action. It wasn't that I offered my resignation. I resigned.
So you put out a statement. It says, while I do not agree that the Society statement was in any way intended to defend racism, I accept it could have been much clearer in its condemnation of bigotry and has clearly caused upset. The original statement was not intended to gloss over the fact that the media industry in the UK does have work to do on inclusivity and diversity. So that's also the kind of statement that we've become used to recently, which is the terminus, the end of these kind of controversies, when someone ultimately resigns, and then they put out these statements that always have the same kind of language and the same kind of tone, which is a sort of slightly, may I say, defeated sounding tone, where you sort of say, okay, you win, I'm gonna fall on my sword.
Yeah, I could see that, yes. Defeated, no. But the aim was to give the Society a breathing space, to get the jackals to back off, and to enable it to continue on with its work. And we, as I'd said, we'd never said that there wasn't work to be done. And looking back, could I have made that clearer in my initial statement? And the answer is yes.
So you do think you did something wrong?
I did something wrong only in the sense of I wasn't clear enough in what I was trying to say. I did absolutely nothing wrong in defending the British media in saying that it is not intrinsically racist or bigoted. And I didn't apologise for saying that.
Let's have a look at the actual substance for a bit, because it's really quite interesting, isn't it? On the question of, is the British media racist? The controversy that has ended your career with the Society of Editors, at least. I noticed that during the famous interview with Oprah Winfrey, they put up some screens mid-interview of examples of the hostile treatment Meghan had received during a discussion about racism. So in the middle of that screen, there's a headline from the Daily Mail, and one of the words is actually blurred out. You have to Google it and look it up separately to find out what they're actually talking about. And it turns out this is a column by Sarah Vine, the Daily Mail columnist. And the headline is, "Yes, they're joyfully in love, so why do I have a niggling worry about this engagement picture?" And the word niggling is then blurred out in the Oprah interview. And it's worth saying that hundreds of millions of people have seen that interview, so we'll presume that whatever was underneath that blurred word was a racial slur of some kind. I guess the idea is that niggling sounds like the N-word.
That was my understanding of it. And what I've read is that niggling is not a word that the Americans use and so would not perhaps understand, but they could very easily have understood it. I'm just talking about the presenters of the interview that Oprah did could have come to understand it by just simply making a check. That it obviously is not a racist slur.
And you don't think that's a racist dog whistle? You don't think Sarah Vine there is trying to deliberately use words that sound a bit like other words in order to sort of make suggestions in the back of people's minds? You don't buy into any of that?
I don't buy into any of that at all. But at the end of the day, the point is that it's not my opinion on that that particularly matters. Yes, it's going to, there are some controversies that some people will discuss and say, I see this as having racial overtones. I see this as an example of bigotry. The point that I've been making across is that even if you can find elements of that, and I'm not saying that I will agree that that is racist or not, that is not proof that of general racism, a general racism approach. In that particular case, no, I don't think so at all.
Let's look at another example. You did a much shared interview with Victoria Derbyshire from the BBC, where she was very aggressive with you, trying to establish why you could defend the press, which in her view was self-evidently racist.
Can I ask you about those headlines again? The Star asked whether Harry would be marrying into gangster royalty.
I'm not going to defend one headline.
Sorry, Mr. Murray, you just told me. Excuse me. Please, may I speak?
Please,
may I ask the question?
The huge amount of coverage. That's
Mr. Murray, you can continue talking over me, but I want
one or two examples and say, ah, look, here's something that someone might point to and say. So therefore, that means that
Mr. Murray, you told me the British tabloid press was not bigoted. I've just given you some examples. You're denying that those examples are racist. And I'm asking, why are you denying that?
The numbers one and two examples that she hit you with in that live interview were one from The Star and one from The Daily Mail. And I believe The Star used a headline saying that Harry had married into gangster royalty. And The Mail used the phrase straight out of Compton to describe Meghan in a piece about her family and where they were from near the Compton neighborhood in California. What's your view now in the cold light of day about those two examples, which you said weren't racist in the Victoria Derbyshire interview? Do you still think that?
I'd not heard of the film out of Compton, so I was genuinely not aware of what that was, and it struck me with that example that it was a straightforward, you know, embellishing of a rags to riches kind of story. I just simply can't believe that any newspapers in this country intentionally will be complicit in allowing their journalist or anyone to actually be deliberately racist and bigoted. I just can't believe that exists into there. But you know, this isn't just on the right. I mean, we've had the Guardian, for instance, and a lot of controversy over when they produced a cartoon of the Home Secretary Priti Patel and depicted her as a fat bull with horns and a ring through her nose. And I think the Times of India even said that they thought that had racist overtones, but it's controversial. I don't believe that's what the Guardian meant with that cartoon, but it's an example. Does that mean that the Guardian should therefore be considered a racist paper? Sorry. It's the same with the BBC. The BBC have had complaints about them, you know, kill Whitey. That was a joke. That was a comedian. It was in poor taste, but a lot of comedians are. They were the complaints about that. They brought out a survey on Twitter where they asked, is it true that all black people like chicken? It was actually a terribly cack-handed way of trying to you know, destroy stereotypes. There were a lot of complaints about that. And in fact, they took that tweet down, which does seem to be an admission that they realised they had a problem with it. But does that and other examples mean that the BBC is inherently racist? Please, come on. No, of course not.
It's also...
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Striking that of the thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of articles written about Meghan in the months and years since her marriage to Harry, these were the very worst examples that could be found. Right, that's what was selected in order to make the case. And it's not a long list. It's quite quickly becomes anything negative about Meghan. And I just wonder what your thoughts are, thinking about the earlier period, when shortly after her marriage. I remember that being a very positive period for her, and she got the normal British press treatment.
Exactly, Freddie, exactly. It was almost as if, let's just basically forget about the fact of the euphoria, the absolutely overwhelmingly positive coverage in the British media across the board when this, you know, this person came into the royal family's life. She was of mixed race, a breath of fresh air, and here she was. And it was positive, positive, positive all the way through the wedding and everything. Yes, OK, she got family problems and that was highlighted and written about. And then afterwards, yeah, began to rub people a little bit up the wrong way by saying this is the way that you should live your lives, which is always difficult to do anyway when you're a rich and privileged person who's now in the royal family. And by the way, we're not going to actually live our lives like that. We're going to jet around the world in jets. But you.
So you're referring there to this green agenda. They took a private jet to, I think it was Sicily. Yeah. There was a climate summit. Yeah. And
you're going to get negative coverage when you start doing those kinds of things. And as I tried to point out, and I believe in the Victoria Derbyshire interview, it's not as though every other member of the royal family, particularly those who have married into the royal family, haven't had their fair share of criticism, including Kate, weighty Katie, if you can remember back to that. And you look at Fergie and you look at Diana herself, and then you look at all the members of the royal family, and you can accuse the media of being, you know, unfair, at times nasty, at times cruel. But even after that they'd announced that they were leaving the country, there was still huge amounts of positive coverage that was there. But what we've got to, you picked up those two cases there. The other famous one is the avocado story. The avocado story, there was a story about, you know, a picture of Kate handing Prince George, I understand, an avocado, and it was lovely. Oh, what a lovely little present and everything. And then there was a story about a month or so later about the ills of the avocado trade, and it depicted Meghan as saying this is Meghan's favorite food, and little does she know, you know, so on and so forth. And there we are. This is how they treat lovely Kate, but this is how they treat. Yeah. Now, you can look at that and say, and there are reasons behind that story and why it ran the way that it did with things. And Meghan wasn't the only person that was actually mentioned, a celebrity that was mentioned in that article about all these celebrities love avocados, but they don't know the harm they're doing to the world. You could say, at best, that's unfair that Princess Kate got dealt with in this way, the Duchess of Cambridge was dealt with in this way, and the Duchess of Sussex was dealt in this way. But so that's
what's your explanation for that then? Why did the media turn at least partially against Meghan, but didn't turn against Kate? If it's not race, what is it?
Well, I think it's just quite simple. There are two things. One, we don't like being preached to by members of royalty in particular, but shall we say we don't like being preached to, the British people. It's that simple. And the second thing is that we definitely don't like being preached to by people that are preaching one thing and then being appearing hypocritical and doing something completely different. And that's how it was. It's all very well. And also, you know, you only have to look at it. Meghan and Harry, they made it plain that they didn't particularly like the press. They made it plain that they were going to do things their way. And, you know, if you're going to say, look, we don't like you, well, you know, parts of the media are going to say, well, we don't like you either.
What's interesting is that what's happened to you is because race is involved in the equation, of all of the different factors, that it is one, it is present. And therefore, we suddenly get to a situation where to minimize it or to disagree with the idea that it is the dominant factor makes you out to be a bad person in some way. You then are the wrong side of a moral divide, and you got caught out there. You found yourself on the wrong side of this.
Absolutely I did. And it was brought home to me mostly the day after I'd resigned, actually, because once I, as I say, very quickly made that decision by myself to resign and to go, I sent quick messages to family, close family and friends to say, I'm resigning. I'm just in the process of resigning. I'll explain it all to you, because they weren't following all of this. This was an industry thing that was going on. I'm in a good place. Don't worry about it. I thought I'd let you know because there might be a little bit of coverage of it tomorrow, and didn't want to come as a bolt out of the blue. Little bit of coverage. You know, I was the number one news item on every BBC bulletin from first thing in the morning throughout the whole of the day, on the hour, you know, half an hour, on the 15 hour, every 15 minutes, TV, radio, everywhere. Every other broadcaster picked it up. It was in most of the papers, and a lot of them were actually very supportive of me. It broke in America. I had friends, colleagues, family who live in North America, Canada and the States contact me to say, you're breaking news. I was being discussed on news discussion programs in Australia. As a question, I popped up in a question on Question Time that night.
But what does that make you think, though? I mean, was the net effect that it looked like a victory for that campaign then? Did it look like you had admitted fault?
Well, exactly.
The campaign had been successful, and that's why it was a big news item.
Well, exactly, because a friend that on the end of the middle of all that, who works with the media and knows a lot about it, and she said, I'm sure you'll take this question the right way, Ian, but why is it that the resignation of some bloke that no one's hardly ever heard of from some organisation that no one's hardly ever heard of is the number one news item in the UK and trending all over the world? And I said, well, you know, look, I know why. There are three reasons. One, it's the Meghan and Harry, you know, sparkle dust coming down from Hollywood. The second one was that I was following in the wake of Piers Morgan, who had resigned a little earlier before I did. And so therefore, I mean, he's far more well-known than I am. And so therefore, here's another person that's been forced to go. The third reason, which goes to the point that you've made, that it's a change from being a classic witch trial, whereby someone who is accused, stands up to defend someone who's been accused of being a witch, it must therefore be a witch, to become the culmination of a classic show trial. And what happens at the end of a show trial is when you've got your admission, when you've got your culprit, you must shame them publicly. You must make sure that everyone gets the message that if you don't agree with what we say, if you push back against anything what we say, that this is what we'll do to you. We'll come for you. We'll come for your family. We'll come for your career, your friends, anyone that associates with you. So don't question. Don't question.
For you personally, what has the experience been like? I mean, you were a hardworking, successful journalist who had this position, and now you no longer have it. You've lost your job. And now if you Google your name, these will be the things that come up, possibly for many years to come. This is now a big part of your life story. And how does that feel?
Am I bitter and twisted about it? I can be. I can be pretty annoyed about it. In the first stage, you're obviously in shock from doing it. You take an awful lot of comfort, and I have done, from the outpouring of support from people I know and people I never met at all, including lots of reporters on those papers coming to me saying, you don't know who I am, but thank you so much. We are not racist, and we needed someone to actually say that for us, and support from a lot of people in the industry. Disappointment that with some others that I thought were friends or associates who ran for the hills, shall we say. And it slowly dawns on you, well, not slowly dawns on you, but reasonably quickly dawns on you that your reputation has been shredded in some ways, that it's been tarnished.
Have you got a new job?
I have always been a consultant on media matters, and it's my intention to continue to do that and continue. I think I can talk with even more knowledge now from being, right in the centre of this. I want to actually be a commentator on all of this and to actually speak up, because I think, I could easily just go away.
But I mean, are you okay financially? Because part of your income, or a big part of your income, has just disappeared.
Am I okay financially? It's a blow. I'm not your Piers Morgan, who can say, stuff it, I've got millions. And anyway, his career continues on with those kinds of things.
So that's why I'm asking, Ian, not to try and embarrass you personally, but to say that, there are real people at the other end of these witch hunts, and it makes a huge difference to their lives. And when Victoria Derbyshire is having her 10 minutes with you on BBC News, and everyone signs open letters, and then they get a scalp, and then everyone moves on, what we're left with is you now for the rest of your life.
Look, I'm not going to plead poverty. Let's just say, as I explained to my wife about this, that if it was going to happen, I'm glad that it happened when I was 62 and not 52 or 42, when the kids were younger, and we weren't in a position to be, financially solvent, which we are. Yes, it's wrecked plans leading up to retirement and all those kinds of things.
So, Ian, let's zoom out then and say, what does this make you think? Where are we? We're in quite a frightening place where gangs like this can form on the slightest apparent transgression on one of these hot button issues. They think they're being virtuous and are on the side of the angels, and they form a rampage, and then you have events like this. Is the world now quite a frightening place? What does it make you think about the state of the media and the state of free speech?
I think it is a very worrying place. Look, I can be annoyed with the left of the media, who traduced me, who damaged me, who they didn't set out to set the mob on me, but were part of what happened to me. But I'm not going to say that they should be silenced. I'm not going to say that they shouldn't have a voice. Now, they're hugely hypocritical of me over all these years. I want them to continue to have a voice. I agree that the BBC, needs to be reformed. I don't think anything it's doing at the moment is actually going to achieve that. But I'm not going to join the camp who say that it should be defunded. I don't think that's going to make it at all. I think that we should have one real last, effort to try and drag the BBC back to the centre ground, because it's absolutely vital.
Because you think it's left-leaning?
Yes, when it's described as left-leaning, I always think that basically if the Tower of Pisa was leaning that far, it would have crashed down an awful long time ago. And I'm liberated now from the Society of Editors. I could never say that, quite rightfully, because the role was to gel it together as much as possible. But free of that, I can be honest about things and say, of course it is.
So free speech then, as a sort of theme, as a feeling, do you think we have it? Do you think right now, in this country, we have free speech?
No, we don't. We don't. Because when, you speak your mind, and someone like me and many others speak your mind, and you're crushed, back to the show trial thing, where you lose your income and you face that kind of a reaction, a mob, because of expressing an opinion, of course not. And there must be, and we are seeing this over in the United States. We're seeing that there's people that are frightened to actually express an opinion. And I think it's going on in this country as well. And I think it's growing. It's absolutely vital for politicians and those of the establishment and those in a position to influence to actually stop denigrating the media, stop pointing fingers at the press, stop saying things like, well, we believe in a free press, but just sort of not those guys over there kind of thing. Because that way of undermining the media, undermining the press, actually gives validity to those who attack them. It gives validity to the mob. So when are they, you don't come more establishment than the grandson of the monarch. So when two very rich, privileged people that are, whose opinions are followed by an awful lot of people attacked the media in that way, where were the government to actually stand up and actually say, no, hang on a second, we disagree with that. That's not true. Because if it is true, guys, why is it that before and even after those statements, you're still quite happy to write columns to go into those papers when it suits you, and you have been doing very recently? You know, so guys, where were you talking, walking the walk there and coming to the defence of me and the industry as a whole? No, was there none. But on the whole, they're doing the right things. But don't, you know, one change of government, the Labour Party are no fans of a free press. They certainly don't like it on the one side. And in recent times have been pretty vocal about the kind of changes that they would like to make, which would be restrictions of the press. And we've seen what's gone on over in the United States, haven't we? We saw President Trump, you know, threatening or musing over, I've been threatening really to take away the licenses of broadcasters he didn't like.
And now and he himself has now been chucked off social media.
And now he's been chucked off. And I wrote a piece in the Telegraph, actually saying that he should have his voice back. If the former most powerful man in the world can be denied a voice by Twitter, by all the social media platforms, when he hasn't been convicted of any crime, then what hope for the rest of us? What hope for the rest of us? And don't think they can't come for this. What we have seen happening, what led to my cancellation, although I contend I'm not cancelled, what led to my cancellation was an attempt to emasculate, to continue to emasculate one section of the media. You'll be very careful now, won't you, whenever you write anything about all these kind of things, because in that. And this will continue. This will continue until enough people stand up and actually say no. All voices should be heard within the law. There are laws in this country. I've never advocated. I don't think we should have complete deregulation of the media. I do not believe that there should be no regulations whatsoever. You know, when you talk about free speech, absolutely not. You know, hate speech, I understand. No, there's no point. And in real racism, Freddie, I would not have stood up to defend a racist press and media. It's as simple as that. But now it's becoming to a point that if you try to defend against anything, you're going to get swamped and attacked and overwhelmed. And that has a chilling effect. That makes people will step back. Whether they are in the media or elsewhere, it's censorship. It's self-censorship. And that is a dangerous thing.
Ian, let's leave it there. Thank you so much for your thoughts today. Thanks for telling us about your experience.
Thank you, Freddie. Thanks for the chance.
That was Ian Murray, until very recently the executive director of the Society of Editors, the organization responsible for defending free speech, defending a free media, and he was forced to step down after having transgressed on the issue of racism and whether the British press were racist towards Meghan. Great to hear from him. Quite a sobering interview, I thought, to see what the human side of some of these stories can be. Hope you found it interesting too. This was Lockdown TV.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.